Hello, and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. If you're lucky, once in a while on your literary travels, you'll come across a book that will be unlike anything you've ever read before. This is especially true if you concentrate on a specific genre or theme, like mystery novels, biographies about your favorite personality, or, well, I don't know, let's just say baseball books. You've read so many of these things, and hopefully many of them are enjoyable, but to find something truly different is the pot of gold we hope to find after so much time spent. For me, The Last Innocence, the collision of the turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers, is such a book. I believe my age demographic, those who came to baseball after the Dodgers left Brooklyn in the late 1950s, is the perfect audience. And Michael Leahy does a marvelous service to his subject. A handful of players on that team, including Maury Wills, Sandy Koufax, Sweet Lou Johnson, Tommy Davis, Jeff Torborg, Dick Trzewski, and Wes Parker. Not all of them were superstars. Koufax was the only one of the group who was inducted into the Hall of Fame, but they were all a part of a special time in the history of America, and the fact that they were merely athletes does not diminish their thoughts and contributions. Leahy delves more deeply into the personae of a baseball player, going into areas of self-doubt on both a personal and professional level, than any author I've come across. The drama goes beyond the game on the field into real-life consequences, but without the overwrought stylings other writers try to infuse in their projects to give it a sense of gravitas. Suffice it to say, this is one of the best, most thoughtful books about baseball and the people who participate in it you're likely to find.
Michael Leahy, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
So Roger Kahn's Boys of Summer was considered a love song of nostalgia for the older boomer generation. Do you consider The Last Innocence along those lines for those born at the end of that era?
I suppose inevitably there'll be some of that, Ron, for some readers. I suppose I also wanted to reveal the 60s for readers through the player's eyes, and particularly the eyes of the seven principal characters, these seven Dodgers around whom I based the book.
Now, how were the Dodgers embraced when they came to Los Angeles in the late 50s? There's something almost romantic about Brooklyn. Did that translate to the laid-back Los Angeles temperament? Aside from my wife's Uncle Philip and his family, were there many New York transplants who followed the team?
I think it was more a case, Ron, of Los Angelinos who whose exposure to baseball to that point, professional baseball, had been limited to the Pacific Coast League and to those two hugely popular Pacific Coast League teams in Los Angeles, the Hollywood Stars and Los Angeles Angels, suddenly having a chance to watch a level of game that was off limits to them unless they traveled a couple thousand miles at the time to St. Louis and, say, Chicago. I think it's fair to say Los Angeles was enraptured when the Dodgers arrived. There was this huge parade, Ron, on the eve of the opening of the 1958 season through downtown Los Angeles, which then, as now, is a city hard to rouse. This is a city that prides itself on not being deeply impressed by displays of glamour. You know, after all, this is the city of film stars and recording stars, and yet they went nuts during that parade. They were nuts over the Dodgers. And, you know, they during that first season in the Los Angeles Coliseum, in 1958 and through the 1959 season as well, they could put 90,000 people in the Los Angeles Coliseum for a baseball game. So So I think it's fair to say the Dodgers had no trouble drawing fans immediately in Los Angeles. I also think it's fair to say early on, Ron, that Walter O'Malley and the rest of the Dodger organization and the Dodger fan base in Los Angeles sought to distinguish this club from its Brooklyn predecessor. They were trying to make the point from the very beginning that this was a different product than the one in Brooklyn, that there would be a different identity. And you saw, and I think you probably saw that most manifest itself when the Dodgers moved into their new ballpark, Dodger Stadium, in 1962, and you could see those totemic palm trees, enormous palm trees behind the left field pavilion. I think that, you know, that was part of the Dodgers' statement that this is a different club from Brooklyn. This club has its own identity. So I think the short answer, Ron, is that the L.A. immediately not merely embraced but fell in love with this club, saw the Dodgers as part of its identity at a time when it was still trying to labor to feel like it was a big city, you know, that it was on the level of New York and Chicago. To this day, the Dodgers remain a core part of the city's identity.
Now, you mentioned the seven players in your book. Kahn focused on stars of the team like Robinson, Erskine, Reese, Campanella, those guys. Yours is more egalitarian. It's across culture. You focus on people like Maury Wills and Sandy Koufax, but you also highlight players like Wes Parker, who was certainly a very good player, but no Hall of Fame candidate.
Right.
And even Dick Trzewski, who was a middling middle infielder. How did
right.
you decide on those players as your main characters?
I guess for starters, I wanted Dodgers who would be able to open a window on what it was like to play in the 1960s. I also wanted a cross-section of players, those of different backgrounds. Here we have four whites, three African-Americans. I wanted players who had different sets of professional challenges and personal challenges, sometimes even problems. Wanted people of different skill levels and of different temperaments. So as you mentioned, Koufax obviously is the sun around which all these other bodies sort of revolve. And then you have Maury Wills, this electrifying base dealer and the team's captain, who in my judgment, like Koufax, belongs in Maury ought to be in the Hall of Fame, ought to join Koufax there at some point, and Drysdale. Then, as you pointed out, we have the six-time Gold Glove first baseman, Wes Parker, who grew up in this extraordinarily wealthy Brentwood family, living around movie stars on his street in Brentwood, but had a horrific youth. He was the subject of physical abuse in his house, and something that no one, of course, on the outside knew anything about. He never shared that secret with his teammates or friends during his playing days. This is the first time he's ever talked about it, but it was something that plagued him throughout his career, the feeling that if he failed, it would be confirmation of all he had heard during his youth, that he was worthless. So baseball ultimately proved to be his salvation. And so he's a character. Tommy Davis, the great National League batting champion in the early 60s, is one of the seven principal characters. Then we have, on the subject of sort of the egalitarian spirit that you referenced, Lou Johnson, who spent nearly all of his 20s in the minor leagues and would never have likely made it to the Dodgers, Ron, but for the fact that Tommy Davis broke his ankle early in the 1965 season. Johnson was brought up from Spokane to the Dodgers and became a hero that season. Koufax, among others, thought that the team would not have won the pennant that year but for Johnson's contributions as the team's starting left fielder. And then Lou hit the what would prove to be the game-winning home run in Game 7 of the World Series that year against the Twins, the game, same game, of course, that Sandy Koufax, pitching on 2 days' rest, threw a three-hit shutout, and the Dodgers won the title. And then we have a reserve catcher, Jeff Torborg, who, of course, went on to become a major league manager. And even as a young man, people could see Torborg's prowess as a leader. And then, as you pointed out, Dick Trzewski, who was absolutely selfless, could not have been more admired by his teammates whenever he was needed. And he was needed in critical roles in the Dodgers' World Series triumphs in 63 and 65 because injuries inserted him into the starting lineup. Trzewski was beloved and also happened to be Koufax's closest friend on the team. So they serve, these seven principal characters really serve as a window onto baseball in that era and this very tumultuous decade.
You mentioned Parker's dysfunctional family situation. How did you get that information?
Well, it's a great question. Why, you know, I think not only Wes, but Lou Johnson and some of the other, and Maury, decided to share some of these stories because they have, I think, understandably, a greater sense of their mortality today. These are men now in their late 70s and early 80s for the most part. I think they have some sense that that time is ticking, and they wanted to tell these stories before it was too late. As you point out, I knew nothing about Wes's saga before we began the interviews for the book, and one day he just started telling me, and he would tell me a little more with each interview. We did more than 40 hours of interviews together, Ron, and so it didn't come all at once, but it came steadily during the course of those interviews, and as well as did his discussions about his self-doubt during his days as a Gold Glove starting first baseman for the Dodgers. There's one anecdote in the book where he was terribly worried about, and this happened more than once, terribly worried about facing a formidable pitcher that night at a game at Dodger Stadium. And the pitcher on one night was the Reds fireballer Jim Maloney, a terrific pitcher for the Reds and somebody who threw in the upper 90s. And Wes was terrified about the possibility that he might have a horrible game at the plate. And he thought for kind of a fleeting moment that perhaps it would be best if he were not to play at all, if he were not to play ever again. He had really had to steel himself in his home to simply to get himself out of that chair and drive to the ballpark for the game. He thought, my gosh, if I fail, this will be confirmation of what I heard in my home when I was a youth. This will be a huge source of embarrassment for my friends who believe in me. I won't be able to live this down. So he was plagued by those kind of doubts more than once, but finally he would just push off from that chair, get into his car, make the 35-minute drive or so to the stadium, and once he was in that stadium, surrounded by these people he regarded as brothers, people like Maury and Don Drysdale and Jeff Torborg and others, he was fine. And an extraordinary thing about Wes was he really was at his best. This guy who was a subpar hitter on was at his best at the plate in the greatest moments of pressure with games on the line. And when I asked him about it, he thought it was a simple function of the fact that he could not permit himself to fail. If the game was 11 to nothing and he was at the plate, the same pressure didn't exist. He could make out and it would not be a source of embarrassment. But if the game was, if the Dodgers were trailing 2-1, there were bases loaded and two outs in the ninth or eighth, he felt compelled to deliver or suffer this acute embarrassment. So, he talked about all these stories, Ron, during the course of those 40 hours, and his candor grew as our interviews moved along. And so I can't thank Wes enough and can't thank the other players involved in the book for being brave, for being candid, for sharing so many stories that they had held back for so long.
Now, the story about Parker, for me, was certainly the most moving in the book, and I think that's something that separates The Less Innocents from just about any other baseball book I've ever read, is that this role of empathy, this role, I mean, you never read about players having these kind of self-doubts to this extent. Most of them are painted in heroic terms. Some have overcome situations that they've used as motivation for making them stars, but nothing to this level. You must have gone in with an idea of what you wanted to write. Did this particular episode change anything you wanted to do? Because you were never privy to this kind of stuff before.
Right, it's a great question. It did. I would have never imagined before getting deep into the research that someone like Wes Parker, and for that matter Lou Johnson, would have emerged as such critical characters. It seemed as I began the research that Maury would be at the core of this, and that perhaps, and obviously Sandy. And then after that, I guess if I'd had to guess at the very beginning, Ron, I would have said that, say, Tommy Davis would have occupied an even greater role in the book than he does. But the stories of Wes and Lou and the struggles and the struggles they had to battle against, very personal struggles in Wes's case, and struggles more related to the time in Lou's case. I would not have known before the research began that those struggles would have come to be right at the heart of the book. So you're absolutely right. The research did shape the book, and that's why Wes is so prominent at the beginning and end. The book, for your readers who haven't seen it yet, Ron, chapter one begins with a scene where Maury is sitting alongside Sandy Koufax, and the two men are opening each other's hate mail. Maury was on the brink of breaking Ty Cobb's single-season stolen base record in 1962 and was receiving all sorts of mail from white racists around the country who also sometimes threatened him in their notes, men who did not want to see Cobb's record broken. And so Sandy would open up Maury's hate mail and sift out the bad letters, and Maury would open up Sandy's hate mail because Sandy was receiving tons of anti-Semitic mail. And so each man was devoted to the other. Each man had the other's back. They would open up each other's mail, and predictably, being ball players with a great and sly sense of humor, would kid each other as they would open up these letters. You know, Maury would say, "Sandy, you don't want to read this one." And Sandy would likewise say something like, "Maury, you don't want to go near this one." And but they could not have been more devoted to each other. So the book opens with that scene and then explores Maury's early years in the minors before he went up to the major leagues and achieved greatness. But the book then moves quickly to a scene where Wes Parker, adrift as this wealthy young man who's gotten out of college and has no professional prospects and is out of baseball, he had stopped playing baseball, was sitting around a hotel room in Paris, beating himself up, as he often did, about how he was adrift and seemed to have no life plan. And suddenly it occurred to Wes Parker, this insane dream really, that he could pick up a phone call and launch a professional baseball career. So that scene was so moving to me, Ron, that at the end of the book, the end of the book brings us back to Paris, where and revisits with the reader Wes Parker fleeing his Paris hotel room, running down the street to a TWA ticket office and buying a ticket so that he could fly back to Los Angeles the next morning, make this crazy phone call to the Dodgers saying he wanted to get a tryout. And that crazy phone call led to the Dodgers referring to him to a winter league in Los Angeles where amateurs played ball, and the Dodgers told him that, "Look, kid, if you show the scouts something, maybe one of our scouts or a scout from another team will sign you. The chances, Ron, of that happening when he played in that knock-around winter league in 1962 were about 1 in 1,000. But Wes was signed and then went into the minors, and then this Cinderella story ensued. So you're right. I mean, I had no idea what shape the book would take before hearing these remarkable stories.
And getting back to the relationship between Koufax and Wells, you got Koufax to talk with you, but only because it was going to be about someone else, only because it was going to be about Maury. There's a passage you write about where you're telling him about a personal memory of seeing him throw his perfect game, and he just shuts up.
Right.
Now, you mentioned that these guys are getting on in years. Koufax is 80 years old. I keep wondering when and if we're ever going to get to a situation where he finally decides it's time for someone to tell his story in an author. I mean, of course, there have been biographies about him, an especially good one by Jane Levy. But, again, it was something with which he gave his permission for but did not cooperate with. So what do you think it is about Koufax, since we're going into personal psychologies, that prevents him from doing this?
He is a man. Even during his playing days, he was uncomfortable with publicity. He was uncomfortable with the focus on himself. Trzewski talks about that at considerable length in the book. How they could be it wasn't necessarily in Los Angeles. They could be in Pittsburgh or Cincinnati, and stepping out of their hotel to get a bite to eat at a nearby restaurant. And Koufax would suddenly, somebody would recognize him, and there would be 50 or 100 people suddenly gathered to see this idol. And It would even surprise Trzaskowski. I don't think to this day, Ron, that people are entirely aware just how much of a charismatic idol Koufax was. He was this extraordinary athlete. He was this incredibly graceful man. He was movie star handsome. He could have been, had he chosen to do so, a very successful politician in the aftermath of his playing days in Los Angeles. I mean, this man was the Beatles, with the 60s baseball version of the Beatles. And so I think that, and Trzaskowski and Tommy Davis and Maury all agree that this wore on Sandy in a hurry. And I think, and say in the book, that I think part of the difficulty for him now in hearing these sort of questions about himself is that he naturally feels sometimes caged in the 1960s, a captive of the 1960s. And I don't think there's anyone among us who would be comfortable being feeling caged in a particular decade of our early life, you know, whether that's the 60s or 70s or 80s. My sense is that Sandy, like everyone else, wants to feel like a vital force in this era as well as during his baseball stardom. So I think that sense of captivity in the 60s wears on him, and so any questions about him evoke that. You know, like you, I'd love to see the day when he would sit down not merely 20 minutes, but for, you know, 2 hours or 20 hours about this extraordinary career in life, because it's more than a career. I mean, he stands for something, and he has inspired so many. And I think history, not only Sandy's history, but the history of baseball in the 60s would benefit from a deeper understanding that he can only provide about what it was like to be him in that era. You referenced that moment when the two of us were chatting, when though the ground rules of our discussion, Ron, had been that my questions would be simply about Maury, whom Sandy was talking to me about, by the way, for your readers, because Sandy deeply believes Maury belongs in the Hall of Fame. And among other things during our chat, he wanted to make the case for Maury being in the Hall of Fame. And every now and then when we were talking, Sandy would, of course, make some reference to some other player. He believes, for instance, that Tommy Davis would have ultimately made it to the Hall of Fame but for his injury, that there was a good chance that Tommy would have made it to the Hall of Fame but for his injury. And he referenced briefly Wes Parker's skills as a defensive first baseman. But we were talking almost exclusively about Maury, and I just couldn't help it. I mentioned to him that I had attended his perfect game in 1965, and we were doing this interview over the phone, and suddenly it became silent over the phone. And I did think for a second that, for just an instant, that maybe we had lost the connection, but I could hear sort of over the hum, the same hum that I hear right now, Ron, with us, and realized that no connection had been broken, and he just wasn't talking. And then it occurred to me. I wised up. I had crossed the line, and I realized he didn't want it. I wised up, realized he wasn't going to talk about it, and I realized furthermore that he wasn't going to say to me, I'd prefer not to talk about that subject, or I'm not going to talk about that subject. There is an incredibly graceful, gentlemanly quality to him in all moments. So he rebuffed me in that moment. He did not talk about it. He did not talk about the perfect game, but he could not have rebuffed me more courteously or elegantly. He waited for me to get the message that he wasn't going to talk about it, and then it finally occurred to me what was going on, and we simply segued into more questions about Maury. So, you know, when you come across a man who handles a moment like that so gracefully, it just ramps up your interest in talking to him yourself a little more down the road, or hoping that someone else will have that opportunity to, so that we can expand on the history of this extraordinary figure in American athletic life.
Due to technical considerations, I've had to divide this bookshelf conversation into two, which makes it double the fun. So tune in again next week when we will have part two of the bookshelf conversation with Michael Leahy, author of The Last Innocence. Until then, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews of baseball literature, etc., etc. And if you have a question or comment, please email me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Until next time, so long, everybody.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonder."